The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So, it was interesting writing this talk in a time period where I feel like we could desperately use an anti-war movement and we don't necessarily have one, and I think the polarization that's taking place in society right now. I think the interesting thing for me, and I'll, you know, part of what I'm trying to do with this discussion is kind of open up a discussion. One of the things that I kind of, as I was reading this, so I read Bukharin for the first time, but I had read Lenin's imperialism like 4 or 5 times now, and mostly tied around a lot of the anti-war work that I had done in the past, or even the economic crisis in 2007, 2008. So it was interesting to revisit Lenin, but reading Bukharin for the first time, there were a lot of things that I came away with, like, you know, writing in the margin, well, that didn't actually happen, or that wasn't the trajectory. But what was great was that I understood that Bukharin's writings were kind of the basis for Lenin to develop his analysis further. And the more that I kind of dug into sort of the, you know, why they were writing and what was the context of what they were writing, it really then spawned a bunch of ideas for me about how do we build an anti-imperialist current today when we don't necessarily have an anti-war movement, but our movements that we do see could actually use it and are pointing way towards that kind of an opening for that type of analysis in ways that I hadn't ever seen before. So for me, I go back to March 2009. I was then in the Boston branch and went to DC for one of many mass marches, or what we thought were mass marches. I mean, in March 2009, it wasn't a mass march. There were several thousand people, but I remember being at that march against the war in Iraq, and it was the first time we had kind of centered the Palestinian issue and had Muslims marching and American Muslims marching side by side with us, and that the protest was very centered. And I remember being a little bit naive. I said, this is a great turning point for us. Little did I know that that would be the last time we had a march in DC, and that that was, you know, kind of the death of the anti-war movement. It was 7 years after the invasion of Iraq. And to, to recognize why I had that sense of hope, you know, was a set of politics coming into the movement, was that in February 2003, there were 800 cities across the world, millions of people against the impending U.S. invasion of Iraq, and it was the largest protest in human history at the time. And that, to me, was the start of that anti-war movement. And I think that, you know, there's several things, both some of the politics, like, you know, we were in the minority to bring the Palestinian issue. There was lots of debates about taking up the attack on American Muslims at the time, just in the climate. This is coming out of, 2001 and the World Trade Center attack. But I also think, you know, at the time too, a lot of the movement went into Obama's campaign. And, you know, it was interesting to kind of go back, and I remember they had this throughout his entire presidency, sort of this like political tracker of his campaign promises. And, you know, going back, and I forgot that he had, you know, said for sure, well, I knew this one. He was said he was going to close Guantanamo Bay and never did. But he also ran on the idea, and I think most people who voted at that time thought he would actually remove troops from Iraq. He never really promised that he would pull out of Iraq. He promised he would start taking troops out of Iraq. So today, without an anti-war movement, I think the reason why it's important to be having this conversation and trying to recreate and open up these kinds of discussions is because we have a generation of youth who know nothing other than the U.S. at war as a sole superpower tied up in a never-ending war on terror and a planet headed towards climate disaster. I mean, these are the realities of the world that we live in today. So what I'm going to try to do with this talk is kind of get some context for the debates that were taking place at the turn of the century, take up the question of imperialism. Both the theoretical contributions of Bukharin and Lenin at the time, and then the Marxist method that they used, because I think it's really important, because to me, it's sort of like being able to understand the method that they use gives us a method that we can apply to today. And then I'm going to open it with some open questions that hopefully, other people can bring up questions, but I think part of it to me is like, I think there's still open questions around this debate. Well, we obviously know, and there's a talk down the hall on Syria where this is an extremely important question. So the context, before we dive in to the theoretical contributions of Bukharin and Lenin around the question of imperialism, we really need to understand what was happening in the world at that time. Between 1910 and 1920, for about 10 years, we had a living, breathing international working class movement and socialist parties that were involved in that movement. The last wave of strikes prior to that period was between the years of 1869 and 1875 for about 6 years. And then that period in the early 20th century was not met or matched again on a global scale until the waves of strikes and wildcat strikes that began in 1968 and lasted for 6 years till 1974. There were two unique aspects about the global working class movement at the turn of the 20th century. It's not that it lasted longer or included more workers, or it included revolutionaries from anarchists to socialists and youth brigades to seasoned liberal labor militants. I think to me, the two things that happened at that time period was one, the outbreak of World War I and in 1914, and then two, the Russian Revolution in 1917. It really put a lot of questions about what the socialist, revolutionary socialist current needed to be doing, why people needed to be revolutionaries at that time. So the question of imperialism, both Bukharin and Lenin spend much of their time taking up arguments against Karl Kautsky at the time. He was a leading theoretician in the German Socialist Democratic Party. Kautsky was founder and then editor for the publication New Zeit, which was translated to New Time, from 1883 to 1917. That's a hell of a long time. He was recognized as one of the most influential leaders of social democracy and an authority on Marxism until the Russian Revolution. To understand Bukharin and Lenin's focus of their debate, it is worth looking at the trajectory of the Second International that united the socialist left navigating through the period before and during the international working class movement of the early 20th century. Founded in 1881, the Second International was made up of political parties with elected leaderships, political programs, and membership bases in each country. The respective parties built unions and were involved in the life of the working class in each country they represented. Some of the early years were marked by great unity around particular issues, including in 1893 establishment of the International Metalworkers Federation, uniting metalworkers across the world. In 1896, they affirmed the right of nations to self-determination in opposition to colonialism. And in 1907, they hosted the first international conference on socialist women. In the lead up to 1914, it seemed like the majority of European socialists of the Second International were united against colonialism and would proceed through the international working class movement, united on the simple demand of workers of the world unite. But the betrayal came not from the movement itself, but from the largest socialist parties in the Second International, namely Germany and France, when in August of 1914, they sided with their ruling class in their own countries at the launching of the bloodbath that would become World War I. Described as a betrayal to the working class movement by both Bukharin and Lenin, they attempted to put forward a Marxist analysis required to move the revolutionary left forward during one of its darkest moments. After the war broke out, Kautsky would Kautsky argued, imperialism is just a question of power. not an economic necessity. If the war was just a power struggle between groups of arms dealers, financial institutions, and politicians, then all we needed was the democratic unity of the working class and the good capitalists. That's unity with the ruling class, is what he was arguing. His so-called unity would cause a turn towards peace and would bring forth what he called ultra-imperialism, where a section of capitalists would realize how damaging wars had become and would vow to peaceably compete with each other. It wasn't just Kautsky's theoretical writing that was a betrayal of Marxism, but what became apparent through the debates that opened up was that there were sort of kind of three camps, distinct camps and trends within the Second International. In the international around the war. So the U.S. Socialist Party and the German SPD were both split on the question of colonialism, with reactionary forces from both organizations contributing to the racist right wing of the international by accepting colonialism as a natural consequence of, quote, the civilizing mission of European capital and advocating for the superiority of white workers. And the first socialist voted into office in the United States under the Socialist Party was Victor Berger. Even at home, he defended segregation in the U.S. on the grounds that, quote, Negroes and mulattoes, sorry, I'm having trouble getting this to scroll one line at a time. Negroes and mulattoes constitute a lower race that the Caucasian and even the Mongolian have the start on them in civilization by many years. Kautsky fell into the center of the debate along with Rudolf Hilferding, Bukharin and Lenin actually quote from some of his writings, who often spoke out against colonialism. But they also believed that there was no sort of necessary relationship between capitalism, colonialism, and inter-imperialist warfare. Their political strategy was aimed at mobilizing workers to pressure capitalism into a path of peaceful development and a nonviolent transition to socialism by means of elections and gradual reform. The revolutionary left on the debate around imperialism included Lenin, Bukharin, Rosa Luxemburg, and Leon Trotsky, who argued that colonialism and the outbreak of World War I developed from the existing structures of capitalism. Imperialist war and colonial domination were inherent component of capitalism, and only a revolutionary strategy could hope to end the system's drive to war. Lenin argued that socialists should not just refuse to support their own ruling classes, but should openly call for their defeat. He also continued to support the Second International's call, remember when I said back in 1896, for the right of oppressed nations to self-determination. National independence itself cannot bring genuine liberation without the overthrow of capitalism, but the fight for independence would weaken imperialism in support. For that fight by workers in the oppressing nation would cut against patriotic nationalism and make possible a genuine internationalist socialist movement. The question of imperialism that was the demise of the Second International only to be followed by the Third International after the successful Russian Revolution of 1917, which attempted to generalize that experience. So let's dive in to the theoretical contributions. The two pieces of writing is Bukharin's writing on imperialism and world economy, written in 1915 originally, and then finally printed in 1917, and then Lenin's Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, which was written in 1916. I think it's worth noting that both of these were written under conditions of censorship and exile for both of them. So, Bukharin when he finally gets his manuscript back, says, you know, most of my statistics here aren't really relevant, or they were off, but, you know, put that aside and still take, still read. He think, you know, the contribution, I think, theoretically, was still pretty solid for both of them. And then, too, when the manuscript by Karin had gotten lost and then found, and so when he wrote kind of the last chapter, it was right after the Russian Revolution, so he kind of had a different spin on it, and a very hopeful. He had hoped at that time that the book should soon be transformed from a weapon against imperialism into a historic document and relegated to the archives. Unfortunately, we are still here needing to discuss how we actually overthrow the system that breeds imperialism. Bukharin set out to provide a systematic analysis of the dynamics of capitalism and the underlying development of imperialism. His analysis took on kind of two contradictory tendencies in modern capitalism. The first was the concentration and centralization of capital. As this process develops, the state comes to play an increasingly active role in managing the economy, or a tendency for capital and the state to become more and more closely integrated and finally merging together into what he called state capitalist trusts. The second point, or even on this, I think it's interesting because he had a lot of emphasis on the merging of the state with capital, and my perspective in reading this was sort of like, I think he was at the time mistaking sort of the wartime efforts. Remember, World War I is the first, this is the first time the world had ever seen anything like this, and the way that countries went into having a heavy hand in production, I think kind of skewed that a little bit, because he ends up saying that it was going to be a trajectory of capitalist development. You know, and he even talks about it, the exigencies of the war and of the imperialist preparations for war forces the bourgeoisie to adopt a new form of capitalism, to place production and distribution under state power, to destroy completely old bourgeois individualism. He goes on to predict even after the war, there is, quote, no doubt that the trajectory of production will keep on increasing in this manner. And then I would say Bukharin's analysis on this point concludes that these new state capitalist trusts would be only affected by outside crises, glossing over kind of the internal contradiction and competitions that that it continues to exist in the capitalist economies. The anarchic nature of capitalism is not resolved by this, and internal competition among capitalists also shapes the political landscape of the state. His second point that he draws out in his writing is the concentration and centralization of capital. As the centralization of capital unfolds, there's a tendency for production, trade, and investment to break out of national boundaries and to become organized on a global scale. As a consequence of this economic competition between capitalist groupings, capitalism takes on the form of geopolitical competition, where economic competition is now expressed in terms of political and military rivalries between states for territory, influence, and power. And I think that, to me, is like the strongest point that he brings forward, and then Lenin kind of picks up on it with his writing in 1916, and tries to, you know, again break it down into kind of like what are the key aspects of the development of imperialism. And he defines it as five essential features of imperialism: the concentration of production and capital developed to the point that in order to maintain profit and dominance, this concentration required the formation of monopolies. And according to Lenin, these monopolies played a decisive role in economic life. Here, I think Lenin puts his emphasis on the monopolies rather than Bukharin's state trusts as an essential feature. His second essential feature, and I think the key to his writing, is the finance capital, that finance capital is the merging of bank capital with industrial capital. His third point is the export of capital is separate and distinct from the export of commodities. The fourth point is the formation of international capitalist monopolies which share the world among themselves. And then five, the territorial division of the whole world among the greatest powers flows from this development. This economic development shapes political development, and while imperialism itself is a necessary feature of capitalism, the political policies of the ruling class in each country spills forward into the world arena, quote, towards the violence and reaction. For Lenin, the movement, the characteristic feature of imperialism, not merely the movement of industrial capital used for investment and development of production, but of finance capital which allows the great powers striving for conquest of territory or control. And, you know, we can look at examples like the control of resources in the Middle East today. The U.S. doesn't necessarily need that oil, but they play a role in controlling the spigot with their imperial policies. And they do this not only to strengthen their foothold, but to sometimes weaken their competition. What the last 50 years has showed us is that the division of power between powerful states and the rest of the world isn't static. By highlighting the fact that imperialism isn't just a policy and the global market is a product of capitalist expansion and development, finance capital didn't only play a role in the development of capitalism on a global scale, but plays a role today on leveraging the new geopolitical formations and relationships. Foreign investment, it's done through things like foreign investment. I think that's why as socialists we talk about imperialism always having an economic and military wing. Economically it's not just wielded by states through tariff trade deals and wars, but also by the domination over weaker nations or the propping of up or wholesale investment in weaker nations to create regional alliances or challenge a global power by investing in a neighboring weaker nation to play a larger role in containing the competition. So the method that they used, again, you know, I gave sort of the framework of both of them, but I think what made it very unique in the writing around imperialism at the time, because they often, like others, drew upon sort of the bourgeois economist literature at the time, mostly because they're very honest about what they're doing and where they're headed, and you know, we'll have statistics that are useful to be analyzed. And I think, but you know, what made it different in the way that they used those writings was they went back to the original writings of Marx and Engels, and they outlined the outlines they provided on the development of class society, the development of capitalism, and they attempted to outline and analyze whether what they saw at their time as a continuation of capitalist development or a change in that development. At the heart of Marxist method is being able to develop an ongoing, historically specific path for winning liberation for all of humanity that combine defiance of oppression and exploitation with a social force potentially capable of replacing the elite with a democratic common association, what we call socialism, as opposed to a new ruling class. Over Marxist lifetime, he tested, revised, and fought for his ideas over the course of four decades. He never really completely rejected or left behind anything he previously had written or positions he had taken, but radically reconstructed his understanding of social dynamics based on new knowledge, critical analysis, and political struggle on the ground. Bukharin, although I would say a little bit mechanical about the likely future outcomes of state capital trusts and the impending collapse of capitalism based on his enthusiasm over the Russian Revolution and sort of like equating and this is how he expressed that enthusiasm in his wrap-up, was equating the international working class movement of his time as the expropriating of the expropriators. His final chapter was written 1 month after that successful revolution. And it was the first and only time the working class led to overthrow a monarch and then the capitalist rulers of Russia. I believe his analysis of imperialism showed that monopolies were the product of capitalism, and imperialism was a result of capitalist expansion on a world scale. Lenin refined Bukharin's analysis and placed the role of finance capital in the development of imperialism in the state as an organization that developed in the interest of capitalists, and how an understanding of imperialism equips us to understand and appraise modern war and modern politics, even to this day. Lenin's look at the works of Hobson, he quotes from that. His writing really came out of Hobson's piece on imperialism written in 1902, and Hilferding's piece, Finance Capital, in 1910, rightly identified that those writings only went so far as to try to explain here's imperialism. Lenin's purpose of analyzing the development of imperialism was to explain in order to change the trajectory of world history. In particular, it arms us as revolutionaries in understanding that it is not a fight over policy of this administration or another, or between this country and that country, and that this project our project in the U.S. is and has always been a bipartisan effort, or it's been a bipartisan effort on their part. That's what we're fighting against. We can't side with one party or another. Besides developing and understanding political, economic, and social theory, Marxist method of incorporating new insights in the best conclusions of previous battles arms us with developing perspectives and strategies for the next steps in movements, the next turn in struggle, the ability to assess and bring forward the lessons of the past, always with an eye on strengthening the only power capable of overcoming the potential barbarism ahead of us in what it feels like every day, and that power being the global working class. And I think, just in simple terms, when we say the Marxist method, I think it's, one, analyzing the history from a standpoint of socialist revolution, and that's the way we should always kind of go into trying to understand where we're at any moment in time. And then understanding the conditions of capitalist development to act on them with the collective active will of the working class. And it's just, to me, it's so simple in those two things, but it's something that gets caught up in most ways, particularly, at a point where I think, the left is not necessarily, is actually very weak today. And so it's like we're having to relearn a lot of this. Most of us aren't taught it. So most of us coming upon it the first time, it's an, eye-opening experience. And then to find out that there's revolutionary socialists that carry this history forward is extremely inspiring. So the application of the method today, I feel like we're not at a point of a world war at present, and I, as a revolutionary, I have thought that there's the potential of it being at any moment in time, particularly since the economic crisis of 2007 and 2008, and watching the Trump administration and his tweets from hell, there's kind of a sense of this impending doom in many ways. But I think that as I said earlier, we have a generation of youth who know nothing but an endless war on terror, and in the theme of Another World is Necessary of this conference, the role of socialists need to prepare the left and ourselves, I think, takes sort of like patiently taking on these arguments today and building an anti-imperialist current where there is struggle. And I think in this, I think I've seen examples of where the question is very imminent, like Syria, I had mentioned earlier. It's not, some of the protests that I've been to, there's either short-sightedness on saying that it's just a regime change strategy for the U.S. in the I'm not going to talk about Assad apologists in this, but I think genuine kind of confusion of how to understand what's happening in the region. And I think the only way to understand what's happening in Syria right now is to, one, understand Assad's role in his regime in carrying out a neoliberal project in Syria, or attempting to carry one out, understanding who were the forces that rose up against Assad, the effect that the civil war has had, both in displacement and in the revolution, the effect on the revolution in Syria, understanding the contending political and organizational forces. And it, you know, to me, it's sort of like digging in deeper than, you know, my simple tagline on Facebook as this first came out, which, you know, in many ways is in the same spirit, but it means that we have to have deeper analysis and deeper conversation around where I said neither Washington nor Moscow, neither ISIS nor Assad, long live the Syrian revolution. And it's something that carried us through for several weeks, but I think still it's really hard today. So where do I see the glimmer of hope in a lot of this? I think the recent response to the Families United and the way that immigration and even migration on an international level, you know, in the analysis, Bukharin and Lenin also talk about when they opened up the world market, it also opened up a labor market in many ways. And it has the potential, you know, when you read it in writing, it feels like that potential for international solidarity seems so eminent. But then when you see the way they actually carry out imperialism, they do everything in their power to limit our movement. It is, you know, whether it's, and it's not just through the borders, but it's also in the way that they carry out. And so I think that's playing out. But when, you know, when things like global economic crisis hits and polarization, I think that, you know, when you see thousands of people that come out and demand an abolishing of ICE in the United States, that, you know, can lead to deeper discussions about what it would mean. I mean, it's an opening for a discussion around opening the borders, and that would be a threat to the imperialist project of the United States. I think the other place where I see hope is around climate justice. And even years in, you know, since the economic crisis, there's been a movement, I think, in the Bariads called System Change, Not Climate Change, and like making this, moving away from an individual environmentalism to a social justice environmentalism that understand a collective, and taking on the issues of climate justice both at home and abroad. And I think the most recent example was when Standing Rock stood up to the pipeline. Like, that had an opening for an anti-imperialist current to be developed. And so I think as socialists, what I'm trying to argue is that we want to be able to have these discussions not just in the context of an anti-war movement or an anti-war stance, but I think that we need to be building an anti-imperialist current through the movements that we have today. And I'll leave it there and see if there's other questions. I mean, the ones that kind of popped into my head that I know still exist, and besides critiquing the relevancy of Lenin and Bukharin's writing, again, you know, I don't come at this from an academic standpoint. It seems extremely practical to me as a revolutionary socialist who comes from a working class background. But I do think there's questions out there that exist still to this day. Do U.S. workers benefit today from U.S. imperialism? And one of the other ones. Let's see. Oops. Oh, and I think the idea of like imperialism is just a foreign policy is very, very much. I mean, I did a little digging just to see, you know, how widespread it is in mainstream. And not only did we live through post-racial America under Obama's presidency, but he was also labeled a post-imperial ruler by Robert Kaplan at the Center for New American Security. He said, in defense, how did he say it? Oh, it was an article that he wrote called In Defense of Imperialism, and he said, it can ensure stability and protect minorities better than any other form of order. The case for a tempered American imperialism. Anyway, I do think that a lot of these questions, so there are no questions that are, you know, too, you know, simple or, you know, whatever your thoughts are, but hopefully we can have a rich discussion. Thanks.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.